You are hearing voices.
Just remember, at this point, when he gets this last one, the Marines are going to come over.
And when you guys are ready to go,
so now pretend I'm the Marine, okay? I'm going to come in here. I'm going to tuck in the three rounds. He's going to just turn around and march off. And when you're done with your talk, I'm going to still be back.
Sailors practice folding the flag while Marines rehearse a 21-gun salute in preparation for a funeral. They're at Calverton National Cemetery on Long Island, part of a military honor guard for a fallen Navy SEAL.
You're going to go ahead and lift the flag and hold the flag about waist high, right about where you guys have it now.
This is called a four-man fold that we usually use for the full honor ceremonies that we have. It consists of the four men folding the flag, an additional two people receiving that flag and presenting it to, in this case, it's going to be an admiral and a SEAL team member to present to the next of kin, the fiancé and the mother. So it is much more difficult to do it on a person that passed away while on active duty, especially when you look at the date of birth, and usually it's less than mine, so that kind of hits home.
Right at the beginning, before the chaplain does his benediction,
you're going to be holding it the whole time.
You're going to hold it all the way through.
After the American Civil War, communities in the North and South began setting aside a day to honor those who had fallen. They say 620,000 died in that war. 620,000. More than the population of Denver, Milwaukee, Baltimore, or Memphis. After World War I, the holiday became known in some places as Decoration Day. Today, the last Monday of May, is Memorial Day. I am Major Robert Schaefer, United States Army Special Forces, the Green Berets, and this is For the Fallen, a Hearing Voices special supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the National Endowment for the Arts. During this next hour, it is my great privilege to bring to you a collection of stories honoring those who've made the ultimate sacrifice for their country, for us. We will hear veterans and family members reading letters, telling stories, and remembering their loved ones. I hope that you will take a few minutes out of your holiday, surrounded by family and friends, to listen and think of those who've given their lives so we might all enjoy the freedoms and blessings of our hard-won democracy.
Well, it's part of military tradition and courtesy that when we do a full honor ceremony that we present a 21-gun salute in honor of the fallen. So that's what my Marines are here for. It consists of a 7-man detail, each firing 3 rounds. And when you get ready to fire, they go to a 45-degree angle so that when they fire, the rounds actually go over the casket.
Aim. Fire. Ready. Aim. Fire. Ready. Aim. Fire. Freeze it.
Day is done. Gone the sun. From the lake, from the hills, from the sky. All is well, safely rest. God is nigh. TAPS, or Butterfield's Lullaby, its original name, has the power to reduce the strongest and the bravest among us to torrents of silent tears. I and so many others have stood in formation and watched as our brothers and sisters were laid to rest. And no matter how much composure you think you have, if you've lost a friend in combat, as soon as the bugler blows those first few notes, you know you're going to lose it, standing in front of everybody with tears falling down on your uniform.
Parade. Rest.
And as those sad, slow notes linger, the faces of my buddies all come back to me, and I mourn them all again.
Exiting. Detail. Out of 10.
Most of all, I think about Joe Sapancic. Super Sapancic. We called him Super because he was the best of us all. I think about Joe and when we stood on stage next to each other being awarded our Green Berets. I think about what a damn fine soldier he was and how I was always a little envious of him because he could always do things a little better than I could. I think about our 2 years of training and then heading off to 10th Special Forces Group together. I think about how happy I was to see him a year later. His team relieved mine on a mission in some godforsaken place, trying to keep people from killing each other. I remember leaning over a wooden table in a bombed-out room and pointing out to Joe on a map the exact spot where I had driven over a mine. I was lucky to have survived. I warned Joe to watch out, to be careful there. I'd been home for 2 months when I heard that Joe's Humvee had rolled over a mine in that exact same spot. But unlike me, Joe was killed. The bastards had experimented on me, realized they needed more explosive, tried it again, and killed Joe. So whenever I hear taps play, I think about standing there at Joe's funeral, crying like a baby. I feel guilty, because I think it probably should have been me. Am I responsible for Joe's death? Of course not. I know that. I hate that damn song. And I love that damn song. Because even if it means that I'll be embarrassed and cry like a baby, at least I'll get to be with my buddy Joe for a while. Taps is played more than 5,000 times a year at Arlington National Cemetery. When we hear taps, we salute if we're in uniform and place our hands on our hearts if we're not. You should too. I'll be thinking about Joe. The Military Honor Guard was recorded by Charles Lane of SecondWindow.org with Navy Lieutenant Commander Snyder and Captain Coe and Sergeant Trigger, U.S. Marine Corps. The bugler was Lieutenant Lortiz, U.S. Army Reserve. In this next piece, we hear the British version of Taps, called Last Post. Every evening, each sentry post was inspected, and a bugle call was played. The last post signaled the end of the military day. It is now customary at all British military funerals.
It's a freezing cold January night under the Menin Gate in the town of Ypres in western Belgium. We're waiting for two men with orange traffic cones to stop the cars whizzing by so that uniformed veterans can blow the last post in honor of the British soldiers who fought and died defending this town from the German army between 1914 and 1918. This ritual has been performed every night at exactly 8 p.m. since 1927 when the gate was built. It's as big as the Arc de Triomphe. The only time it had to stop was during the German occupation in World War II. Then it took place in England until Belgium was liberated. Even tonight, in this cold, there are about a dozen onlookers here. Three couples with children, one man with a video camera, in silent tribute. The walls of this gigantic stone arch are completely covered with names. 54,896 names of the men whose bodies were never found, who could never be buried in individual graves. Private Peter Walsh, First Class, Lance Corporal Beckwith, AWA.
I was hid behind a big tree that was knocked down or fallen, and I could see these Germans in the woods across this big field, and I saw this young kid crawling up a ditch straight towards my tree. So I let him crawl. I didn't fire at him. But when he got up within 3 or 4 foot of me, I screamed at him to surrender. And instead of surrendering, he started to pull his gun towards me, which was instant death for him. But this young man, he was a blonde, blue eyes, fair skin, so handsome. He was like a little angel. But I still had to shoot him. And it didn't bother me the first night because I went to sleep and I was so tired. But the second night, I woke up crying because that kid was there. And to this day, I wake up many nights crying over this kid. I still see him in my dreams, and I don't know how to get him off my mind.
Shakespeare wrote, "A soldier's arm may belong to his king, but his soul belongs to himself. If you're the last thing that a man sees before he dies, he'll live with you forever." You heard Joseph Robertson, a World War II veteran, talking about the psychological cost of killing. We do not want to kill, and it's a mistake to think that soldiers do not honor or mourn their enemies as well. We can teach a man to fight, but he never stops being human. Joseph Robertson's interview was part of the StoryCorps project. The piece before that was sent to us from France by producers Marjorie Van Haltren and Helen Engelhart. And this is the Burma Band of the British Army's Light Infantry Division playing Last Post. In Vietnam, soldiers etched short slogans and even poems onto the side of their military-issue Zippo lighters. Veterans will recognize many of these slogans. They get recycled for new deployments and printed on T-shirts sold in surplus stores around bases. Things like, "When I die, I'll go to heaven because I've already spent my time in hell," or Kosovo, or Iraq, or Somalia. Composer Phil Klein set their words to music on his 2004 CD, Zippo Songs.
When I die, bury me face down so the whole world can kiss my ass.
This is For the Fallen, a Memorial Day special featuring the voices of veterans and their families. Losing someone who has suffered and soldiered with you through tough times is devastating. It can take years before we talk about it. In this next piece, also from StoryCorps, Hannah Campbell interviews her father, Tom Geertes, an Army medic in the 11th Armored Cavalry Regiment during the Vietnam War.
What was the biggest change about you from Vietnam? I was not really worried anymore about being socially acceptable. From the day I got out, I didn't shave or cut my hair for probably a year. And people that I knew before I left, even some of my cousins, didn't think too much of me after I got back. So I took a long bicycle trip.
And went off and got by yourself.
Yeah. I rode straight north up through Minnesota, cut across, and rode all the way to the West Coast. Took me about 6 weeks.
Do you think that you sort of healed from Vietnam on that trip?
It helped a lot. But really, I actually didn't heal from Vietnam till quite a number of years later. I had a janitorial business, and I was doing floors at Sears. And they had a Vietnam movie on there. And something just broke. And I cried. I sat up like a baby for a couple hours while I was finishing them floors. Just sobbed like a baby. Because it was several good friends I lost. It's just too much devastation that I saw there. Just too much hurt. And I really didn't plan on coming back.
I'm glad you came back.
Yeah. Me too. Me too.
My first. She was beautiful, really, really beautiful. But I was afraid to touch her. She was lying at my feet, naked, staring up at me, beseeching. She was 15, maybe. Dazed, I hoped. I think I even said a prayer, "Oh God, please." But the flies told me otherwise. They stood directly on her eyes. They stood directly on her eyeballs and walked across her pupils and pushed each other out of the way to look directly into her eyes before flying off and joining the others, buzzing excitedly between her legs, collecting in her open mouth, a roiling black mass in an obscene kiss. No blood, no witness save that pounding sun, oppressing her dark skin, slowly whitening like desiccated wood. Drenched with sweat from the sweltering heat, I shivered, spat out a mouthful of tepid water, wishing I had a blanket. I wrote that poem because it's not just the faces of our comrades that we can't forget. It's also the faces of the innocents, the victims, those who've been oppressed by tyranny or cruelty. Over the past 20 years, almost every time there's been a conflict, I've been called to go. And as devastating as it is to see my fellow soldiers, Marines, sailors, or airmen killed, it's always the sight of dead children that affects me the most. Although I saw plenty of casualties in Desert Storm and since, it wasn't until I went to Haiti that I saw my first dead girl, and she stayed with me ever since.
Been to hell, live to tell you. Death is my business, and business has been good. If you don't know what hell is like, with me. And you find out.
Composer Phil Klein from his Zippo songs.
I believe that my husband will call me tomorrow.
Becky Herz of Sacramento puts into words the fear that every military spouse shares. Her husband is a sergeant in the Army National Guard. This essay is part of a series entitled, This I Believe.
I believe that my husband will call me tomorrow. Tonight I'll say, have a great day and I love you to my husband who is 11 time zones away in Iraq. Then I'll hang up the phone. I'll fall asleep as I did last night, next to our baby daughter. We'll sleep in the guest bedroom downstairs. It's less lonely to sleep there for now. First, I'll pet and talk to our dogs. I weaned them from sleeping with me a few months ago, but they still seem a bit disappointed when I go off to bed without them. I'll promise them a long walk tomorrow, and I'll make good. In bed, I'll lay my hand on our daughter's chest several times before I fall asleep, just to make sure she is breathing. I'll curl up in two blankets, one from Guatemala, one from Peru. I'll allow these souvenirs of past travels to warm the empty space in the bed. I'll get up three times during the night to feed our baby. Each of those times, I'll tell her that she has a beautiful life to look forward to. I can say this because I believe that my husband will call me tomorrow. In the morning, after my cup of coffee, I'll change diapers and move around loads of laundry. I'll pour dog food, eat cereal, get dressed and do the dishes, all with one hand, holding our baby in the other. I'll do the shopping, pay the bills, and stop in at work to see how my employees are getting by. Every 3 hours, I'll stop what I'm doing to feed, change, and play with our daughter. I'll make good on the promised walk, with our baby strapped to my chest and a dog leash in each hand. When people say, "Looks like you have your hands full," I'll smile and acknowledge that it's true. But I make the best of it because I believe that my husband will call me tomorrow. If there is a letter addressed to me from the military, I'll open it because I believe that my husband will call me tomorrow. If there's a knock at the door, I'll answer it because I believe that my husband will call me tomorrow. And when he does, I'll talk to him and tell him again that I love him. I'll be able to hang up the phone, keeping my fear at bay, because I believe, I must believe, that my husband will call me tomorrow.
Becky's husband David came home on leave a few months ago to meet his baby daughter for the first time. He's now back in Iraq, stationed in Fallujah, and is expected to come home soon. This, I Believe, is independently produced for NPR by Jay Allison and Dan Gettiman, with Emily Botine, John Gregory, and Vicky Merrick. They're at thisibelieve.org. StoryCorps is sponsored by AT&T, produced by Sound Portraits Productions, and on the web at storycorps.net. And this is the U.S. Marine Band. Coming up, troops returning from Iraq and Afghanistan read their journals, poems, and emails. That's in a minute when we return with For the Fallen, a special from HearingVoices.com, supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the National Endowment for the Arts.